Good morning, and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that has no plans to shut down, even if Washington does. I'm Jonathan Lemire on this Tuesday, September 28th. We'll start with the news. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has changed course, telling Democrats that they will vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill before reconciliation is done. In a Democratic caucus meeting last night, Pelosi announced the change of plans. She originally had promised to link the two bills together, refusing to schedule a vote on the Senate-passed infrastructure bill until reconciliation was ready as well. According to a senior Democratic aide, Speaker Pelosi blamed the reversal on the Senate. Quote, I told all of you that we wouldn't go on to the bipartisan infrastructure bill until we had the reconciliation bill passed by the Senate. We were right on schedule to do all of that until 10 days ago, a week ago, when I heard the news that this number had to come down. It all changed, so our approach had to change. It isn't about diminishing the importance of the reconciliation. Politico reports the speaker spoke with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and President Joe Biden before the meeting. They are reportedly hoping the president will publicly pressure members of Congress to vote for the infrastructure bill. Speaker Pelosi is acknowledging she is still unsure what the final number will be for reconciliation. Key moderate senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have both publicly said they would not support the bill at its current price tag. Progressives have said they would vote against the infrastructure bill if it were put up first. That vote is expected this Thursday. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans are making good on their promise not to raise the debt ceiling, even if it leads to a government shutdown. Every Senate Republican voted yesterday against a measure that would fund the government and make sure the country does not default on its debt. Republicans argue that Democrats should pass it themselves through reconciliation because the GOP doesn't support future spending bills. But Democrats say the past debt was incurred by both parties and should be paid for by both parties.
So let me make it abundantly clear one more time. We will support a clean, continuing resolution. We will not provide Republican votes for raising the debt limit. There's no chance Republicans will help lift Democrats' credit limit so they can immediately steamroll through a socialist binge that will hurt families and help China.
The Republican Party has now become the party of default, the party that says America doesn't pay its debts. Keeping the government open and preventing a default is vital to our country's future, and we'll be taking further action to prevent this from happening this week.
Again, Congress has until the end of the week to fund the government before a shutdown begins, and just a few weeks to raise the debt ceiling before the country goes into default for the first time ever, mind you, during a global pandemic. Joining us now, NBC News White House correspondent Mike Memoli. Mike, thanks so much for getting up early this morning with us. Let's talk about the state of play right now. From what you're hearing, your sources are there, you know, on the Hill, in the White House. Will progressives make good on their promise to vote against the infrastructure bill, potentially dooming a signature piece of legislation for this president?
Yeah, that's obviously the question that is raised by the speaker's decision last night. And I spoke with a number of members of Congress after that caucus meeting. And as one of them put it, Pelosi is putting all the rabbits in the hat so she can take them out of the hat. Everyone knows that this is the ultimate test of Speaker Pelosi's ability to win the vote. She's never lost a key vote. And what the takeaway for members seemed to be was that she was really starting the clock here last night. There's, as the president described it on Friday, as something of a stalemate here between the moderates and the progressives in the caucus. And last night, we also saw clearly the stalemate that involves Republicans on the debt ceiling. And now it's up to Speaker Pelosi to try to force a resolution here in that stalemate among all sides. And part of the argument, as I understand it, to the caucus last night is that because of Republicans' refusal to go along with any form of a debt ceiling increase, the full faith and credit of the U.S. on the line, it's looking increasingly likely that a debt limit increase is going to have to be also part of that reconciliation deal. And so that's part of the argument for why Pelosi also has to reverse her previous linking of the two, because they need the time both to find out what that final number is going to be on the reconciliation bill, but also potentially include a debt limit increase as part of that. And so it's interesting the leverage that moderates have maintained throughout this process. And it was clear in the speaker's decision last night that she has to as she often has in the past, mind their concerns ultimately more than others at this point. Those are the members who are majority makers, as another member was putting it to me last night. They're the ones who are concerned about the political fallout for all of this one way or another. And so the speaker is calling the shots here. And now the question is, to use your show's framing, what the president will do to help see this through. The other takeaway from members last night was that the president really does need to lean in here to make it clear to all sides what is on the line for them politically, to show whatever political capital he still has at this point and that he's willing to use it to try to see this through. And right. There are a number of senior White House officials who have been on the Hill, living on the Hill, and the takeaway last night as well was that they actually need to be a little bit more aggressive, to offer more sticks and less carrots as they're trying to see this through.
Certainly, Washington observers for a long time have gone broke betting against Speaker Pelosi's ability to count votes, and I do appreciate the question is framing there, Mike. But this is such a complicated stretch here in Congress. It's going to be this week. It's likely going to extend beyond that. And but the key figure here is someone who's just down Pennsylvania Avenue, and that's President Biden. What are you hearing? We've certainly heard from the White House that the president will be involved in these negotiations. He's got a call sheet. You know, he might be hosting more members back to the West Wing. How involved is President Biden going to be? I've heard that some members want him to step up his outreach here. That they feel like he's going too slowly and perhaps not grasping the urgency of the moment. What are you hearing? What is he going to do, both in terms of the congressional package, but also the debt ceiling and government funding?
So ultimately, one of the tools that the president has is coming up to the Hill in person. And that's something we might want to keep an eye out for here in the days ahead. This president has a call sheet. Obviously, his aides put names in front of him of people who, obviously, as they're in real time talking to members, could use a presidential phone call. Sometimes the president himself is keeping an eye on the television. He sees lawmakers on the air, and he might give them a call himself. This is sort of the nature of how he likes to operate. He sometimes goes beyond what the staff is suggesting to make these personal outreach himself. But we've only seen the president go up to a caucus meeting on the Hill once this entire term. And I think that was one of the other takeaways from members last night, is that maybe this is the time, just like he did as vice president at key moments, including before the ultimately passage of the Affordable Care Act, is to show up in person and make the sales pitch himself. We know the president's going to be traveling to Chicago tomorrow, and the clock is ticking now ahead of that vote on Thursday. So that is something I think I'm going to be keeping an eye on, is whether that empty schedule that we see again for the White House today might ultimately see him racing up to Capitol Hill himself.
Yeah, I was in the press pool that day for his first trip to the Hill, and certainly there was an excitement that greeted him. And certainly I imagine that members there would be appreciate another visit. I think you might be right on that. Mike, MSC's Mike Memoli, thank you, my friend. We'll see you again soon. President Biden is also once again emphasizing the importance of vaccines as he received his Pfizer booster shot live on camera. He also called out the damage caused by Americans who have yet to get even one shot.
You're fully vaccinated, and you're highly protected now from severe illness, even if you get COVID-19. You're safe, and we're going to do everything we can to keep it that way with the boosters. About 23% haven't gotten any shots. And that distinct minority is causing an awful lot of us, an awful lot of damage for the rest of the country. This is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Let me be clear, boosters are important. But the most important thing we need to do is get more people vaccinated.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell also received his booster shot yesterday. On the Senate floor, he called his choice to get the third dose an easy decision and told his own personal story of survival.
I'm a survivor of childhood polio from before vaccines. Before vaccines eradicated that disease here in our country and around the world now. So I've been a lifelong champion of vaccinations. Mountains of evidence tell us these shots are safe, effective, and dramatically shrink the odds of severe disease or death from COVID. Like I've been saying for months, these safe and effective vaccines are the way to defend ourselves and our families from this terrible virus.
R&B superstar R. Kelly could face decades in prison after a jury in his high-profile sex trafficking case found him guilty of all 9 counts in a dramatic conclusion to an emotional trial. NBC News correspondent Stephanie Gosk has all the details.
It's a verdict prosecutors say was nearly 30 years in the making. R. Kelly guilty of racketeering and sex trafficking.
I believe I can fly.
The man who wrote the Grammy-winning 90s anthem, I Believe I Can Fly, now facing decades behind bars.
Today's guilty verdict forever brands R. Kelly as a predator who used his fame and fortune to prey on the young, the vulnerable, and the voiceless.
The verdict caps a 5-week-long trial with often graphic testimony. Victims described being locked in rooms for days for not following Kelly's rules, like not asking for permission to go to the bathroom or making eye contact with other men. Geronda Pace, who appeared in the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly, was just 16 years old when she said she was abused by the pop star.
The breaking point for me was when Rob slapped me and he choked me until I blacked out.
The racketeering charge normally used to convict mafia bosses, allowing the government to introduce sexual abuse allegations outside the statute of limitations. At the center of the case, pop star Aaliyah, who died tragically in a plane crash. One witness said she walked in on Kelly and the then 13 or 14-year-old Aaliyah engaged in a sex act. The majority of the victims, young black girls and boys, at the time of the abuse. The former assistant district attorney who tried Bill Cosby believes this trial could be a turning point.
These were decades worth of tears that these women have been crying. But at least now they are having the opportunity to be heard. They're able to testify and be credibly believed.
1 in 4 black girls are sexually abused before age 18. Few go to the authorities. The defense portrayed the accusers in this case as opportunists who wanted money and fame themselves.
You saw witness after witnesses giving 3, 4, 5 different versions as to what they said happened here.
The jury wasn't swayed, deliberating less than 9 hours total, guilty on all counts.
To the victims in this case, your voices were heard and justice was finally served.
Our thanks to NBC's Stephanie Gosk for that report. The man who tried to assassinate President Ronald Reagan 4 decades ago will be free next year. A federal judge has agreed to lift all the remaining restrictions on John Hinckley Jr. next June, as long as he remains mentally stable and continues to follow the rules imposed by the court. Hinckley, who is 66 years old, was granted supervised release from a mental health facility in 2016. Officials at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute do not support the judge's decision. A statement reads in part, "The Reagan Foundation and Institute is saddened to hear of the decision to unconditionally release John Hinckley Jr. Contrary to the judge's decision, we believe John Hinckley is still a threat to others and we strongly oppose his release." Patty Davis, the daughter of President Reagan, also expressed disappointment in the judge's decision. In a new Washington Post opinion piece, she writes in part this, "People's memories have faded. That burst of gunfire outside the Washington Hilton was a long time ago. I have friends who weren't even born then. But for me, for my family, for Jodie Foster, the memory of that day will never fade. I will always picture my father being shoved into a limousine after a shot struck his lung and nearly grazed his heart." There is no manual for how to deal with something like this. You can't Google it or look for reference material. You just have to live with the fear and the anger and the darkness that one person keeps bringing into your life.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at MSNBC.com/app.
Third downs, you can bring him from wherever you want.
Third and one. Dak to throw for it. He's got Schultz. First down and more. Schultz cuts it back in and into the end zone. Touchdown, Cowboys.
That was quarterback Dak Prescott's third touchdown pass and second to tight end Dalton Schultz in his first home game since the ankle injury that ended his season last year. Running back Ezekiel Elliott rushed for a season-high 95 yards and 2 touchdowns. Cornerback Trayvon Diggs returned an interception 59 yards for a score. and the Dallas Cowboys blew out the Philadelphia Eagles 41-21 on Monday Night Football. Meanwhile, the only birds flying for the Eagles last night were the pair flipped by Eli Manning during last night's broadcast.
You go to Philly, I mean, you're getting the double bird right away from a 9-year-old kid. I would give the bird. I don't know. Can we do that? Can you? I'm sure you can blur that out, right? It's over now. Yeah. So, I mean, getting double bird by a 9-year-old, and they're saying things about my mom and Peyton. And I can't even tell you what they said about mom.
I'm not going to try that here. The Eagles are, of course, a division rival of the former Giants quarterback who made the gesture while discussing his previous experience with Philadelphia fans. Manning soon after apologized.
All right. Sorry. Earlier I gave the double bird. I guess that's frowned upon, so I apologize if I offended anybody. I thought I was just, that's what a 9-year-old did to me. I thought I could do it back.
Not even a single bird here. Turning now to Major League Baseball. The American League wildcard chase has largely been categorized as a 3-team race between the Yankees, Red Sox, and Blue Jays. But a fourth AL team is emerging as a real contender in the final week of the regular season. With a 13-4 win over the A's last night, the Mariners gain some ground over Oakland and move to within a game and a half of the Red Sox, a half game behind the Blue Jays for that second AL wildcard spot. Seattle has two left to play against Oakland before wrapping up the season with a series against the Angels. Meanwhile, to Detroit, where things got testy between the AL Central champion White Sox and the Tigers yesterday. Chicago first baseman Jose Abreu had some words for Detroit's shortstop after being tagged out, attempting to steal second base in the ninth inning of a one-run ballgame, prompting both benches to spill out onto the field and surround the players. Abreu had to be restrained, as you can see, but outside of some pushing and shoving, there was no further escalation. It's unclear what exactly sparked the altercation, but White Sox manager Tony La Russa insinuated Abreu had been intentionally hit by a pitch before the inning before. Chicago went on to beat Detroit 8-7. And in Cleveland, fans at Progressive Field chanted, "Let's go Indians," one final time before the team adopts a new name next season. They cheered the Indians to an 8-3 win in their final home game before they become the Guardians next year. Cleveland gets the best of Kansas City. And Indians outfielder Bradley Zimmer got the best of his older brother, Kyle Zimmer, hitting a solo home run off the Royals reliever in the eighth inning. According to the Elias Sports Bureau, a brother homering off a brother has only happened three other times since 1900. This, of course, did not count all the times that I went deep off my own brother in wiffle ball. Time now for the weather. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Cairns for the forecast. Bill, what do we got today?
We're not seeing wiffle ball weather in the mid-Atlantic and Northeast. Not today. We got showers and storms heading through. Not going to be that horrible. We may see isolated severe weather we'll have to deal with, but we haven't had many umbrella days in areas of the Northeast and mid-Atlantic, so we have a couple today. So if we look at the radar, there is an area of showers and heavy rain, even some lightning right now, just south of Pittsburgh, just south of State College, and this will try to roll through New York City, maybe even Philadelphia for your morning commute. So keep that in mind. It's probably about maybe 3 to 4 hours for the New York City area. So it'd be the tail end of the morning commute there. As far as the severe weather threat goes, Washington, D.C. to Baltimore, we're in a slight risk today. Maybe some wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour. So maybe some minor power outages. This will not be a widespread event, but there will be some isolated strong storms in that area of yellow, which does include southern New Jersey, almost all of Maryland and Delaware. Here's the kind of the timing of this mess. By 11 a.m., notice Boston to Providence through Connecticut, I-95 to just about north of New York City. There's one line of storms and downpours that'll go through. And then later this afternoon, we'll see a second line of showers and storms around Baltimore and D.C. So just keep that in mind for your late afternoon commute, especially D.C., Baltimore, southwards down to Richmond. So the forecast for today, still hot from the Dakotas all the way down through Texas. We're still in the 90s. It's going to be rainy in the northwest. And then tomorrow, we clear it out in the northeast for a beautiful fall-like day with highs only in the 60s. As the wildcard baseball will continue as we go throughout today. Should be fun, Jonathan.
Last night, the Senate failed to pass a key procedural vote to advance a short-term funding bill. It's also a make-or-break moment when it comes to infrastructure. NBC News White House correspondent Kelly O'Donnell has more.
President Biden's political and policy legacy on the line. After his vaccine, his plans in need of a boost.
What is at stake for your agenda and your presidency with what's happening on the Hill this week?
Victory is what's at stake.
First, facing a deadline to keep the federal government open by this Friday, Republicans blocking a bill to fund the government and extend the country's good credit until December. So Democrats will try again. This week, make or break decisions on the president's signature priorities, a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure plan, and the massive climate and social program spending currently at $3.5
trillion. If we do that, the country's going to be in great shape.
Democrat Joe Manchin is a pivotal moderate.
I'm concerned about basically a society moving towards more of an entitlement mentality versus a rewarding mentality.
While Republicans complain the Biden agenda is too costly.
It's paid for by putting a debt onto the next generation of Americans. That's how it's paid for.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
New polling shows the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill passed by the Senate last month remains popular among many Americans. According to a new Politico Morning Consult poll, 56% say they support the bill, while just 27% oppose it. When it comes to the price tag, 42% say that $1 trillion is too much to spend on U.S. infrastructure. 43% say that figure just the right amount. And 14% say that $1 trillion is too little to spend on infrastructure. If a government shutdown were to occur, that same Politico Morning Consult poll finds that 32% of Americans would tend to blame the Democratic Party. 36% would blame both the Democrats and the Republican parties equally, and 24% would blame just the GOP. When it comes to the national debt, 31% would blame the Democratic Party if the U.S. were to default. 39% would blame both Democrats and Republicans, while 20% would blame just the Republicans. Joining us now, co-founder of Punchbowl News, Anna Palmer. She is an MSNBC contributor. We are so happy that she's here during such a busy week. So let's start, Anna. Thanks for being here. What the government shutdown that's looming at the end of the week, which would be sort of catastrophic at any time, but particularly during a global pandemic. What needs to happen for lawmakers to avoid that shutdown, to approve the government funding before Friday? Walk us through it, if you will. I think we're having a little trouble with her audio, but we will bring her back in just a minute. Still ahead, the totally different reporter who crashed Kevin Durant's news conference at the Brooklyn Nets Media Day. Wait, hold on. Now I'm told, this is the beauty of live television, I'm told we may have her audio again. Let's try
good
back.
Morning.
Hi, there you are. Thank goodness you're here. I thought you had lost your voice considering how busy this week is. You're probably screaming at lawmakers. Let's start again. Indeed. Tell us, how can they avoid this shutdown?
Yes, I will just say this. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has a lot of different off-ramps. The real question is, what is his strategy? He could potentially take that bill up again, which is the government funding with the debt limit that we know is going to fail. The second option that we're hearing that he could do is this option that would be funding the government and have it coinciding with this debt limit deadline in October, which would really be a massive cliff. Or the third thing is he could make a government funding bill through early December. So we shouldn't, by all measure, stumble into a shutdown. But as you, Jonathan, certainly know, we could, because Congress sometimes doesn't work the way that the rest of the world seems to think it should.
Congress does love to stumble into things. Let's talk about Speaker Pelosi and the move to push a vote on that bipartisan infrastructure bill without reconciliation. Is that going to work? How big of a gamble is this?
It is a massive shift. You cannot underscore how she has for the last several weeks said that, you know, they have to go with both of these bills twinned together. And last night, the reality struck. She basically had a tough conversation with the Democratic caucus saying, reconciliation just isn't ready. We need to move forward with bipartisan infrastructure. The real question is going to be what happens with the progressives who have, many of them, gone on the record for weeks now saying they aren't going to vote for the infrastructure package without reconciliation. This is going to be a true test of Pelosi's power and ability to whip votes, because there are going to be a lot of unhappy progressives if and when she takes this bill up without reconciliation.
So let's dive a little deeper on that, this split in the party. There's so many progressives who have been, frankly, privately and publicly, sort of angry at the attention that Senators Manchin and Sinema, those more centrist moderate Democrats, are receiving, seeming like they're dictating the terms of this conversation. What alternatives do they have? How can they push this forward? And what sort of role do you think President Biden's going to play here, potentially as a closer?
Yeah, I think the real question is going to be, do the progressive actually bind together and say, we are going to tank this bill this week? I think ultimately, we believe, based on reporting, that the infrastructure bill is going to move forward. It just depends on a when. And it would be a massive sign for the progressives if they choose to actually tank what is basically the legacy of Joe Biden. And also, I don't think you can underscore how much he needs this victory. It has been a tough couple of weeks and months for President Joe Biden. This would be a real sense of victory for him. And I think the real question is going to be, how effective is Joe Biden? You know, he's had people over, they've had cookies, he's been able to kind of do that soft diplomacy from the White House, but can he actually turn votes from some of these progressives? I think the jury's still out there.
It's going to be quite the week. Anna Palmer, Punch Bowl News, thank you so much. And thanks to all of you at home for bearing through our difficulties with Wi-Fi.
Dave from Basketball Digest. Kevin, KD, why do people call you KD? Can I call you KD?
Yeah.
Okay.
My first name is Kevin.
Uh-huh, right.
And my second name, my last name. My second name. My last name is Durant with a D.
KD? This year, what percentage do you plan on giving on the court? 90, 95, 100, 110. What are we looking at?
110.
I just got off the phone with the Dolan family, and they said that they're talking to the commissioner now. They're looking at working a contractual deal that will allow you, when you're not playing for the Nets, days off, you'll be able to play for the Knicks. Comments?
All right, Dave, that was the last one.
I'm sorry, was that a comment?
That was it.
How about you? Do you have a comment? Wrap it up. Okay. I'm being told my time is done. Have a great year. Thanks. What about the Pelicans? When you guys play the Pelicans, does it kind of make you giggle?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's all I got. That's it, everybody. Thank you.
Time now for something totally different. If you didn't recognize that voice and are puzzled by that line of questioning from Brooklyn star Kevin Durant at the Nets Media Day yesterday, the reporter who introduced himself as Dave from Basketball Digest was, in fact, longtime late-night talk show host David Letterman. Love Dave, miss Dave. Speaking of late-night comedy, Saturday Night Live returns for season 47 this weekend with some new faces. Aristotle Autry, James Austin Johnson, and Sarah Sherman all joined the late-night sketch series as featured players. All veteran cast members will return for the next season, with the exception of Beck Bennett, who famously portrayed former Vice President Mike Pence, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell. Featured player Lauren Holt also will not return. Bennett shared a tribute to SNL on Instagram, writing, quote, "Thank you for 8 years of remarkable people and incredible experiences that completely changed my life. I had so much fun." Three top defense officials will testify before a Senate committee today to discuss last month's chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and U.S. CENTCOM Commander Kenneth McKenzie will appear before the Senate Armed Services Committee today and the House Armed Services Committee tomorrow. They're expected to face tough questioning regarding the end of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan, which culminated in a deadly terror attack outside Kabul's main airport last month. Milley is expected to be grilled particularly hard by Republican lawmakers, many of whom have called for his resignation after reports surfaced of a phone call he made to his Chinese counterpart in January without former President Donald Trump's knowledge. And coming up on Morning Joe, we'll be joined by one of the senators on the Armed Services Committee, Democrat Mazie Hirono of Hawaii. Ahead of today's hearing, we're learning details about a warning that CENTCOM Commander Kenneth McKenzie reportedly gave Taliban leaders, which they ignored. Three senior defense officials tell NBC News that in the final days of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan, McKenzie told the Taliban to keep their forces out of Kabul until the U.S. finishes withdrawal of Americans and our allies. If not, he said the group will be met with U.S. airstrikes. Despite reportedly agreeing to those terms, the Taliban ignored the warning and rolled into Kabul the very next day. No military action was taken, despite the threat from McKenzie. Joining us now, NBC News National Security and Global Affairs reporter Dan DeLuce. Dan, good morning. Thanks so much for being here. Let's start there. Obviously, a lot of eyes on the hearings today. Why? What have we heard? What do we know about why the military did not take action after the Taliban ignored the U.S. warning?
I think there are a lot of questions. Exactly what was happening in those really kind of desperate final days and hours. But what we do know is that General McKenzie brought a map to that meeting in Doha, sitting across from some of those Taliban leaders, and he was accompanied by U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad. So it's quite an extraordinary meeting with this four-star general saying, you're not to come into Kabul until we can get all the Americans and everyone out. And he said, you know, stay about 20 kilometers outside the city. And the Taliban explained to him, well, we already have Taliban forces inside some parts of the city. So it was basically too late. And the Taliban offered to be some kind of security liaison and cooperate and basically help provide security around the airport. And after that, the military decided they would have to have this kind of uneasy, bizarre arrangement with the Taliban to try to get out the Americans they could in those final days. And as we all know, it did not go very well. The Taliban didn't allow a lot of people into the airport. But I think carrying out airstrikes would have been a pretty extraordinary decision, high risk. And there were civilians all around the airport. There were a small number of U.S. forces. And we'll find out today, but apparently they decided that was just too dangerous a decision to take.
How much time do you expect senators to spend on General Milley's reported phone calls with his Chinese counterpart, which some have portrayed as sort of common practice, but we've heard from some Republicans suggest that it was insubordination?
You will hear a lot about this today. It will dominate the hearing in some respects. It's certainly, at least from the Republican side of the aisle, you've had Republican lawmakers saying he should resign, that this was unconstitutional what he did. So he will be hammered on this and he will have to answer for that. But as you say, the chairman's office and his defenders are saying those conversations he had with his counterpart in China were completely routine. These are the kind of conversations the chairman has with military leaders all over the world. But according to Bob Woodward's book, he was extremely concerned both right before the election and after the January 6th riot that President Trump was volatile and unpredictable, and that he might stage some kind of military action or provoke China somehow. And he wanted to reassure China, listen, everything is stable, everything is okay, there's no military action coming your way. And that's according to the book. So we'll have to hear what General Milley says today about why he made those phone calls.
And Dan, last one briefly. What else do you expect to hear about that airstrike that was meant to hit ISIS-K terrorists, but instead hit civilians and killed 10, including 7 children?
You're right. That is also going to come up today. And the Pentagon has called it a tragic mistake, that they just got it wrong. And they've apologized and said that they'll look at disciplinary action if necessary. But I think you will hear lawmakers saying, why did this happen? This has happened before. There's a pattern here. You know, why does this keep happening? And I think there'll be some very, very tough questions there.
NBC's Dan DeLuce, thank you so much. And we'll certainly be watching the hearing carefully. Earlier in the show, we asked, why are you awake? Bill writes, I'm up way too early because I had a terrible dream that my Eagles were embarrassed by the darn Cowboys on national TV last night. Bill, I've got bad news for you. Casey, a Brewers fan, is up too early to work for Amtrak. And Theodore tweeted this, too excited for our Tampa Bay Rays to go to sleep. So I'm grading papers instead. The Rays are an overlooked storyline this year for sure. And I have one more here from, I believe it's Amelia Bedelia, who writes, hey, John, I'm up way too early to take my youngest to school in the midst of Lawrence City. Lawrence, Massachusetts. She's talking about Central Catholic High School, my alma mater. Thanks so much for watching.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.